This is the monthly meeting of the Branch County Historical Society held at Union City, Michigan on April 17th, 1977, this nice Sunday afternoon.
Reactivated group has been able, through research, to reconstruct, and he has a good-sized exhibit of things here which he will tell you about. Usually, I believe, three members put on this program. However, the adjutant of the group, of the battery, Mr. Jim Conley, is involved this weekend with a battery meeting, and it was necessary for him to attend that function. And Louis Kyler, also of this battery in the Union City resident, my neighbor, was called back to work today at Kellogg's. And when they tell you to come to work, you come to work. And he called me yesterday and told me that these two absences, though, would have very little effect on our program, because he said, John usually does most of the work anyhow. So I will turn this over to you, John.
As you know, we are members of the Battery C, which is third battery that raised the Michigan Artillery Regiment. Of course, you all know the Battery A, which is known as Loomis Battery, which must have got cold water. Our battery was originally mustered in to federal service in 1861 up at Grand Rapids in conjunction with the 3rd Michigan Cavalry. Shortly afterwards, there was a battery artillery being outfitted and sent to the Western Theater of the War, which was Mississippi, Tennessee, and Louisiana border. Our battery is not quite widely as known as Loomis Battery. They seem to have gotten all the glory and write-ups, and ours were just kind of the...
we have Colonel Loomis's field glasses.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Hmm. It's quite a nice thing. However... Our battery did see considerable amount of active service. They were mustered out in April, sometime in 1865, after the Grand Review in Washington, which they participated in. And between those dates, they were quite active in southern portions of Tennessee and then Mississippi. Primarily, they saw a lot of action around Corinth, Mississippi, and Iuka. They were very participatory in those battles. There was one incident at the Battle of Corinth where they were stationed at the junction of two railroad crossings, and they were told to, hold their ground. They did. The Confederate troops were within 20 yards of their guns before they decided to get out. They suffered not really too heavy losses. I think there was approximately 5 or 6 men killed in action, about 30 some that died of diseases, which is quite typical of the way casualties happened in the war. More men died of disease than they did of actual wounds. The battery had in service 239 men under the command of Captain Alexander Dees from Detroit. At the time of the Battle of Corinth, they were under the command of Lieutenant Robinson, I believe it was. They were very effective in their operations around Corinth and Iuka. They were with a portion of their artillery went with General Dodge on his expeditions into Atlanta or Alabama, where they did a little raiding and general disrupting of the enemy lines. And towards the last of the war, they were under the command of William T. Sherman on his main march to the sea, where they did fight many skirmishes along the route, and they touched at places such as Atlanta, Savannah, Reston, Georgia. They fought at Kenshaw Mountain. Then they went on to Richmond, and at the end of the war they went up to Washington and participated in a grand review. Then they came back to Michigan and mustered out. The reactivated battery was reformed in 1964, don't forget the dates right, and we became members of the North-South Skirmish Association, which is dedicated to the enlisted men in the service of the Civil War, and our primary function is competition using the muzzleloaders and the weapons of the period. North-South Skirmish is a nationwide organization, primarily east of the Mississippi, and we have units in virtually every state of the Union. And it's not uncommon to have Confederate units in the northern states and Yankee units in the southern states. We have to keep the balance a little equal. Each year we have a range at Winchester, Virginia. The organization has purchased 600 acres, and we have what we call our national shoots down there. And they're in May and in October. And everybody, if possible, converges down there for those 2 weekends. And we have a shoot. Our primary targets are bustable targets, such as clay pigeons or clay pots at 150 to 100 yards. And we use replica weapons of the period. Some people use originals, but that's not really too nice young purists. You take away their value a little bit. We also in the North, or NSSA, have a revolver competition, and our greatest function, I feel, as being an artilleryman, is we have cannon competition. And we use cannons that are either original or rebuilt, original cannons, or replica cannons that are modern made. This here is a picture of our cannon that we have. It's a 2/3 scale of a 6-pound field piece. It has a bore of 2 1/8-inch diameter. When we fire these in competition, they are at 200-yard ranges. We have fired this twice in the Nationals. We've only had it for about 2 years now. Needless to say, we weren't really that great. We haven't had that much practice, but we did come in 10th out of 12, which we felt was pretty good for our first time out. Each member of the NSSA must be in a uniform of the Civil War in order to shoot. There's no individual members. They have to be members of a team or a unit. We are trying to strive towards as authentic uniforms and equipments as possible. We have a lot of work to do, but we're catching up. We have penalties assigned to certain violations of authenticity, such as zippers and pants. They must be constructed as the original uniforms were, and it plays for quite an interesting spectacle. You have all the units, various uniforms from 1861 through 65 in various stages of, you know, as if they were issued new or seen 4 years of hard service, and even have state militia uniforms. The uniform we particularly
decided upon was for the Federal Artillery uniform, such as I have on now. And it would be the dress uniform, like would be issued when they were mustered into service. The uniform, I'll explain a little bit about it, I suppose, right off. It's awful similar to the cavalry uniform because the artillery, especially the light artillery, such as we were considered mounted. Over there we have an example of the infantry, standard infantry uniform, and as you can compare that there is a considerable amount of difference. The jacket is what they call the shell jacket. It was a tight-fitting uniform made out of wool. The whole uniform materials were wool. They didn't believe in cotton. The summer uniforms were the same as the winter uniforms. And you may have noticed earlier that I've sweated profusely. And it does get extremely warm. Quite a few soldiers were known to have passed out, even died on marches, particularly long marches in the hot summer. The piping trim on the jackets was the designation of what ranks of service you were. Scarlet was for the artillery, yellow was for cavalry, and sky blue was for infantry. So you could look at a uniform, you could tell at a glance what branch they were in. They were short to allow you to move freely at the waist, made primarily because anything much longer you got in the way when you got on a horse. The trousers, again, were wool, made out of kersey, which is a fairly loose weave. They are warm, and there's no breeze. The breeze blows through them when you're outside, kind of keeping them cool. As you notice, they are reinforced for the areas that you would be setting in, especially outside, primarily because you got kind of wore thin. belt, or the sword belt, as it was known, was designed to carry the saber and the revolver cartridge box. The strap across the shoulder was used primarily to help keep the waist off the side when the saber was worn, to balance it out a little bit. This little container here was known as the cap box. They would have percussion caps, which is the same as primers in a modern rifle. And the revolver would be worn on the left side. The interesting thing is, the ordnance board had this thing about costing the government money. The revolver was in use at the time, however, the sword could be used over and over and over again. That way, that's why they designed it so you use your right hand to grab your sword. That was supposed to be your primary means of defense. Use your left hand to reach over, get your revolver. You know, the chances of people being more right-handed were greater, so that's the reason why they designed it. However, a good many of the people thought, you know, why wait until I get close enough to hit him with a sword when I can pull out a gun and shoot him? The Confederates especially thought that. Yeah, it was the reason why the Confederate cavalry, as soon as they got a couple of revolvers, threw their saber away. They would prefer to use two revolvers when going into a conflict than trying to hold on to a sword. There were variations. Some of the Confederates kept their sabers, primarily because it was regulation. There was a lot of non-regulation equipment and stuff used, but I expect that's in case of any war. A lot of people forget whatever's handy. However, the federal troops were told to keep the saber and use that. common sense would tell me to use the revolver. I'll explain a little bit of the difference in revolvers a little bit later. and back you have what you called the cartridge box. This was a little leather box that kept the rounds of ammunition in for your rifle or carbine, or you carried actually cylinders for your revolver. This particular size was issued to the mounted troops. They held about 20 rounds. The infantry style was much bigger and held 40 rounds. Saber I have is your 1840 light artillery saber. There's a lot of misconception about sabers, primarily due to Hollywood. In all the movies, I shouldn't say all the movies, primarily most of the movies you see of cavalry troops or anybody that has a saber, and they're charging in the battle, they're waving the sword around and they come up to somebody and, you know, pop, goes ahead. That is not necessarily the case. A few of the men would sharpen their sabers. They were issued dull. The primary reason was break bones, because the bone took a lot longer time to heal than a slash would. If it wasn't deadly. That's the reason for the low shoulder scales on the shoulders of the cavalry and artillery. Some of the infantry would also carry it. The saber blow coming down here on the shoulder blade, the shoulder bone, collar blade, would be deflected by this little piece of armor, and thus saving the shoulder bone from getting broke. That was the main target. A lot of the troops didn't like them, especially the infantry. Whenever a green troop would march on to a field where there were veteran soldiers, you could always tell the difference, because the green soldiers had their shoulder scales left. The veteran troops would throw them off as soon as they could, primarily because even a little bit of weight after a long march seems like it's a ton. And they also, on bright sunny days such as today, you have maybe 3,000 to 4,000 men marching. You can see these things at a great distance, so the enemy can tell if there's somebody coming or not. And also, the enemy infantry liked them, because if they saw a soldier with a pair of shoulder scales on a sunny day, they'd be two spots of light, one on the shoulder and one on the shoulder. All they have to do is go, boom, target. So, quite often they're thrown away as soon as possible. I don't think so. Most of the mounted men wore boots, primarily to protect their legs when they were on horseback and they're riding through brush. A hat, I have. Should have got it earlier. Is your what was known as the kepi. This, the hat and most of the uniform was copied from the French army. At that time, the styles were, of the military were based largely on European armies. This particular hat is one that we have decided to use for our battery. And the C in the front would designate Company C or Battery C. The cross cannons on top would designate artillery. The cavalry would have cross sabers, and the infantry would have a bugle, such as the one over there. The one would designate 1st Michigan. This little white, looks like a Maltese cross of some sort, was what was known as a corps badge. These came out in the later part of the war, mainly for identification purposes of the officers to tell if their troops were deserting or not. Each corps would have a specifically designed corps badge. The red circle on the top would also designate artillery. And any other decorations, as you see the feather, soldiers would pick up on the march. Quite often it's a favorite place to stick their pipe. They'd also be issued a pair of gauntlets. These were mainly to protect the hands while riding. Yeah, you wouldn't get your hands, you know,
blistered and so forth, and grabbing on the horse's reins, and give you a little better grip on your saber handle. The sash, of course, is primarily a function for dress only. Again, the color is scarlet for the artillery. And the little bag over here is where you kept all your worldly possessions, if you could. It's known as the haversack. I suppose I probably could explain a little bit about some of the possessions that I feel that would be typical that a soldier would carry in here. First and foremost, though, in addition to your canteen, would be your tin cup. And this cup served a function for almost all the cooking utensils you'd ever need. They put a little bale on it to cook, boil water, to make coffee, and put a little water in there and shaving soap and shave with it. The other implement you might have is part of a canteen you picked up off a battlefield and you put a handle on it. This makes a real nice little frying pan. Of course, had to have something to eat off of. If you wanted to cut down any weight, just eat off your frying pan. And of course, your handkerchief, use that for a hot pad. Or quite often, a lot of the soldiers on a hot day would soak this in water, put it under their hat to act kind of as a cooler. If they didn't have their handkerchief, they could, in the summer, they'd grab a handful of grass and act the same way. As far as your eating rations, which are notoriously bad, the most typical scene of soldiers north and south is known as hardtack. It's hard, primarily made out of flour and water. Just a little cracker. Soldiers would be issued approximately 5 or 6 of these a day, in addition to maybe a handful of cornmeal, a quarter of a pound of salt pork or beef. And but they lived a lot on these, especially on a march. That's why it was extremely welcome when he was marching through the enemy territory to find a pig or a chicken. Something that's fresh. These little crackers would be issued in boxes, wooden boxes, after they left the army bakeries. And it varied between the times of issue and the time it was left the bakery considerably. Sometimes it would take up to maybe 3 to 4 months before it reached the lines. These were also stored outside without cover, in wooden boxes. There's a lot of stories with hardtack. One of the most widely prevailed was when a sergeant and a private was sitting together eating their meal on the march. The sergeant was eating a piece of hardtack. And he looked into something. He bit into something. He didn't know what it was. Because a lot of these things would be contained extra proteins in the form of grubs or so forth, you know. And you really didn't want to, you know, investigate too much. But he was brave, and he looked. And he told the private that he's eating with him there. He says, "I know these things are hard, but I can't believe it. I just bit into a 10-penny nail, and it was softer than hardtack." Another one was that a brigade of men were issued a bunch of hardtack and they were tired of it. So they went up to the commander, and they said, we didn't want this hardtack. It's not fit for human consumption. And the commander says, oh, yeah, it is. And they kept arguing the case back and forth. Finally, the commander said, prove it. So they took a box of hardtack to a nearby field where there's some cattle grazing. And they threw it over there. The cows came up, chomped them right down, loved it. You know. So they decided they'd wait, just make sure. An hour later, they were all dead, the cows. What happened is the cows had ate this hardtack, and then they went and drank a bunch of water. And it swelled up. They made their case, though. However, there are a lot of recipes with hardtack. One of the favorite would be to fry it in bacon grease. It could be edible then. One of the other members of the battery have tried it, and he said it's really quite good that way. I have tried it before as a last resort. Some of the other rations that would be carried, they did have sugar, salt, and so forth. They had tin cans back then, so they were issued evaporated milk. Carnation was just starting up back then, at that time, and they were making canned milk. That's not really a fact that I didn't know or knew until about a year or so ago. But it kind of surprised me that there were tin cans back in the Civil War. They were also canned vegetables, dried vegetables. They call them desiccated vegetables. Probably not all they call them. However, the one of the biggest things that made the hardtack palatable was coffee. These things are becoming quite valuable now, but at that time, the coffee came in an unroasted state. It was green coffee beans. So in order to cook or make a coffee, they had to toast them. So they would get their frying pan, put the coffee beans in them, and put it over fire and toast it. More often than not, however, there was a definite char taste to it. And it's really not quite the flavor that we associate with coffee today. It was really quite more like burnt wood. However, they appreciated it quite a lot. And the first chance they had, they would make coffee when they stopped. Here are the other items I have in here. On a bright day, then some of you have had experience with it. I wouldn't know, I imagine it has changed over the period of years a little bit, perhaps not. But one of the tactics, which also was a psychological tactic, a scare tactic, would be to twirl it over your head. That's where it got its name, wrist breaker, because after a while, your wrist got pretty sore. And it's a good thing they never did sharpen these things too much. Because if you can imagine somebody who just got into the service, he held a job as perhaps a store clerk for most of his life. He'd never ridden a horse before. They gave him a horse, gave him a sword, and gets up on this big old huge critter, and he's about so far off the ground, he's scared to death. He's twirling the saber over his head. The horse's head is bobbing up and down. It's a wonder a few horses didn't lose about this much at the tip of their ears. The infantry also had a saber. Primarily the officers who carried this. This here is your 1840 officer's model. And if you look at it a little closer, you can see it's very heavily engraved and really quite fancy. This little gold tassel on the end of it served a function other than just looking pretty. It's called a sword knot. Put it around your wrist like this before going into action. The idea was if you dropped it, you wouldn't lose it. If it was on a horseback, that's a long ways down to the ground. So that kept him from having to get off the horse and retrieve his saber. I also have the scabbard up here with it. In 1860, the cavalry decided that they would change from the old wrist breaker to a lighter version. And this here is your 1860 version of the cavalry saber, light cavalry. It's a little bit shorter. It's a lot lighter, which is, you know, the soldiers really liked. And again, it has the sword knot, such as would be issued to the enlisted man. Now, the bayonets ahead, as I said before, were triangular shaped. In order to have bayonet practice, for the troopers to know how to use practice, they had to have something that they could use that wouldn't hurt each other with. So this was what was called a fencing bayonet. And this, again, would also just slip right over the end of the rifle barrel. And they had, you know, practice on dummies. However, a lot of that practice was not ever put to use. Primarily, as I said before, they never got close enough. So they found other ways to use it. They made a really good cannon holder, stick it in the ground. Another thing that they found out, that you get two fork sticks, and you get your chicken, and make a rotisserie. Quite a few of them were changed to be used as other items. This one in particular has been flattened out on the end and sharpened for some reason. It is completely unknown as to why. I have corresponded with, I don't know, perhaps some of you read some of Dr. Lord's books, collector's book of Civil War collector's books, just like encyclopedias. And I have corresponded with him about this, sent him some pictures, and he put forth a suggestion that it was used to open crates with. At the time, I thought it might be what was known as an entrenching bayonet, because towards the later part of the Civil War, there was a lot of trench warfare began. Because the Confederates would hole up in their cities and the Union Army would have to lay siege to them. So here they were just standing around. They had to dig with something. So they'd, you know, flatten out the end of it and make a shovel kind of out of it. Okay. However, not all the bayonets were shaped the same as the triangle shape. They had what was known as a saber bayonet. And as the name implies, it could be used as either a sword or a bayonet. And this would be particularly designed for the infield. What looked like a short rifle before is suddenly got a heck of a lot longer. A friend of mine said that the bayonet like this makes a short man look awful tall. Really weren't used in great favor, this style, primarily because they were very awkward. So quite often they found that they made real nice things to chop wood with. Sharpen it up a little bit. Some of the revolvers they would have is some of the more familiar ones I should start out with, I suppose. Two basic revolvers, and the most widely known, of course, is your Colt. This here is the 1851 model, and it's called the Navy. It's 36 caliber. The designation Navy and Army really didn't mean much other than the difference in calibers. The Army model is 44 caliber. This Colt was immensely popular with the troops. The other one is your Remington. As you see, Remington has a style similar to today's revolvers. has a top backstrap here that provides a lot of extra strength. There's a Colt in it. That was one of the drawbacks with the Colt, is that when you fired, there's no percussion cap back here. It'd fall off in between a hammer and a frame. When you tried to pull the trigger, it wouldn't fire. It would just get jammed up in there. And if you can imagine somebody trying to get one jammed in the middle of a battle, you know why they'd like Remington a lot better. Remingtons were designed so the cap couldn't do that. They're a little more reliable, I suppose you say. This particular one here is the 36 caliber. Again, the designation of Navy. It's a little bit shorter than the Army model, which is 44 caliber. Those were the two most popular. The Colt company had an agreement with the Army that they would supply all the revolvers needed for the Army. However, they couldn't make the production demand, so they went to other makers. However, the issued arm was the Colt. Some of the soldiers, in order to get the more reliability, could save up 2 to even 3 months of pay, turn their issued revolver back in and buy a new one if they wanted. They felt if their life was going to depend on it, they wanted what they thought would work. A lot of the Confederate soldiers, again, were issued anything they had. This here is an 1807 Harper's Ferry flintlock, single shot. This was the first pistol ever issued to U.S. troops, enlisted troops. These would be carried on the saddle, big saddle holsters. And it took a 54 caliber ball. And the difference between a flintlock and a percussion is how it was to be fired. You had a little a bit of powder in the flash pan there, and it's very dependent on the weather conditions at the time. If it was raining, if it was really blowing, it didn't always go off. Even if it wasn't, sometimes it, just a pan, powder in the pan would go off, and that's where the term flash in the pan came from. There were a lot of variations, a lot of experimental revolvers in the Civil War. I have examples of a few here. The one I think is really rather unique is this one. It's called a Walsh revolver. It's a 31 caliber. It was not really a military issue. It was to be something that a soldier would have to buy on his own. It's reported that the 14th Wisconsin and 9th Michigan Infantry, some soldiers, would buy these things. The strange feature about this is it looks like an ordinary revolver other than it has two hammers. Now, if you counted the places for nipples in the back, there'd be 10 of them. However, it was only a 5-shot chamber. What they did is they did put a powder charge in, put a ball in, put another powder charge, and another ball. The first time you pulled the trigger, the right hammer would fall, striking the percussion cap. This little raised thing on the cylinder wall held a little tube that the fire would go just before the powder charge from the first round was the end. And the ball from the other round would act as a gas to keep it from both going out at the same time. Another pull of the trigger, the left hand hammer would fall, setting off the second charge in that chamber. Bolt walked back and it rotated to another cylinder. So you had 10 shots. Which, you know, could be an advantage. Another item that came out in the Civil War, the majority of your revolvers were single action, meaning that every time you wanted to fire, you had to have a hammer back with your thumb. you pull the trigger, nothing happens. The Star Company came out with a double-action revolver. Now, this is a standard six-shot. And this, again, is a 36 caliber. Along with the rifles, there was the improvement into cartridge arms in the Civil War, into the revolver arm. This here is a cartridge. It took a 32 caliber rimfire, which I have one up here, two. And the little story behind this one was made by Pond Manufacturing Company in 1860. This was an infringement on the Smith & Wesson patent. And this L.W. Pond, the owner of the company, outright stole this patent without, you know, going through the procedures that you have to do. So the Smith & Wesson Company took him to court. The federal court issued a proclamation saying that all the revolvers that Pond Manufacturing Company made had to be given over to Smith & Wesson free, and stamp made for Smith & Wesson on each of them. So it's kind of a rather unique iron. It's got an interesting story behind it. Now that would be issued to holsters such as this. Again, this is more of a civilian type of arm. This had a civilian type holster, as you see, that was made to be drawn with the right hand. Nice thing about this is it had a little spring on the back to keep the flap shut. This also has a patent date of 1860 on it. To keep your revolver ammunition, which came in two packages similar to the rifle ammunition, you had a little pistol cartridge box. A couple of the more under the table type guns that I have here are these. These have four barrels in them. All four barrels didn't go off with one single squeeze of the trigger. This particular company manufactured this one. Was made by the Sharps, same made the rifles. Load, you put them in like so. And each time you cocked the hammer back, it had a little arm that would rotate the firing pin. So you had four shots. Again, this is a 32 caliber. Remington Company also made one similar to that. Again, it's four barrels. And this was known as the ring trigger because of the shape of the trigger. This is a 30 caliber. For the muzzleloaders that didn't have the cartridges prepackaged, you had to have a powder flask or a container of some sort. And all this was is something to hold loose black powder in. And it'll have a spout on here. Push this little spring, which would open a valve inside, which would allow powder to fill the spout. You close it, you'd have a pre-measured amount of powder there. Some of the other little items I have up here. Again, I told you about the large buoy. This particular item here is sort of a boot knife. I'd have a sheath made in the boot for it. This is also homemade. Another large knife I have here. Be known as the Arkansas toothpick. Story has it, you know, after you get done eating, you clean your teeth with it. Yeah, you'd have to have an awful steady hand. That's why I'm concerned. As far as another form of lighting lamp, this little lamp here was an oil lamp, and it was filled with forms of whale oil or something. And it was known as a hospital lamp. These lamps would be, you could clip them over the sides of your bunks or whatever in the hospital, and light them, that'd be the main source of the illumination. However, I'm sure they carried them in the field also. And, of course, this doesn't really need much explaining. Just kind of kept a little of that in the pocket for fortifications, you know. However, it was not uncommon for the canteen to be filled with some kind of brew instead of water. And speaking of brews and canteens, this here is your standard federal issue canteen. This, of course, would go around the shoulder, such as I have over there. This particular one has been tied in a knot so it could be hung over a saddle horn. You don't really find too many of those with covering on like that anymore. This one here is basically the same thing, minus the cover. However, somebody has added a 1/8-inch piece of pipe straight through the center of it. Goes in here, comes out there, and there's no breaks in the middle. Nobody I've ever ran across can really tell me why anybody would do that, especially in the shape it's at. My own opinion is that it's part of a still. They'd have some kind of condenser. And in the winter camps, when there was no fighting taking place, there's nothing to do, make your own brew. Quite a few of them did. Of course, you had your binoculars, and primarily would be used in the Navy, your telescope. One of the things that were very essential to the commanders in the field would be your compass. This particular compass here came from France. It's imported, and it was used for artillery. It has one thing on there for calculating your distances and so forth. Directions. Over here we have some more little items. This here was what is known as a picket pin. This would be issued to each cavalryman. He carried in his saddles. And at night when he staked out his horse, this would be what they staked it to. They found that in the ground, put their rope through there, and stay there for the night. This was dug up in Virginia. I can't really say where, but it came from battlefields down there. This little cardboard tube has a composition of some sort in it. It was known as a port fire. Came exceptionally useful for the artillerymen when it was raining. It had about the same effect as a modern flare. The rain wouldn't put it out. So they'd light one of these things, and that's what they'd use to touch off the cannons with. Fuses for bursting shrapnel and other forms of bursting cannonballs would come from the arsenals in packages like this. There'd be 5 to a package. These are time fuses. This one here is for 5 seconds. That means that 5 seconds after the cannonball is fired, it'll burst. They had these things for various time limits, such as 8 seconds, 3 seconds, and so forth. They also could be cut down. As you see, this one here, if it was cut down there, it would be last for 1 second after it bursts, which means it'd be just barely out the muzzle of the gun. This little fuse here would be inserted into a plug, which would be screwed into the cannonball. This particular plug here came from some naval yard. It has the Navy markings on it. That'd be inserted into there. It'd have a cover cap over it. And the portion that I'm missing on this one was a water cap, which meant that it would, you could shoot it out, and it could even land in the water and it'd still burst. That's what those would be screwed into, the cannonballs. Of course, in a battlefield, you had to have doctors and because there were wounds. There's your scalpel. A lot of the soldiers' deaths that were wounded was the direct result of the hospital sanitary conditions that were not. Cleanliness was really not known or widely accepted at that time. So somebody who could come in had an arm that has been smashed by a mini ball or something like that, and he could have, you know, been out in the field for several days and gangrene may have set in. They'd cut it off and then he'd go on to the next guy without washing it. So it's quite a, you know, little wonder why a lot of men hesitated about going to the hospital tents if they could. There are a lot of cases where guys would avoid that. They'd rather live with a shattered limb or a crippled limb than have it cut off with the possibility of contacting gangrene. From all the accounts that I've ever read about the hospitals, they were really not the most pleasant place. Usually they were right off the edge of the battlefield, the first where the field hospital were. The soldiers would come in there and it'd usually be heaps of arms and legs laying outside the door as a standard practice, amputated. In the South, they had money, Confederate. As you notice, it's printed on one side. That's because the Confederate Army or government felt that there's no use in printing both sides of the money because it wasted ink, and ink costs money. So they were stretching to extend all their stuff, supplies, as far as possible. I have a couple of pennies here, Union pennies. 3 cents could buy you a lot back then. In cases where they didn't have any money, they had tokens. Sutlers, which were more or less traveling suppliers, would issue their own money for soldiers who didn't have the money at the time to use as credit. There are quite a few different forms of tokens around. This little item here is an interesting item. It looks like a giant jack. It's called a crow's foot, and it was used in the Civil War. And throw a whole bunch of these on the road that the enemy cavalry may be using, and the horses would step on it and cripple the horses. And it was more or less a booby trap. This particular item should be coming out in Dr. Lord's next book, Volume 3 of the Collector's Encyclopedia. He asked me if I could send him pictures of it. He's going to use that in his book. Wow. Other than the solid shot and cannonballs, they had different forms of shot. Spherical case, which looked like a solid cannonball, but had a lot of little balls inside of it with a bursting charge. And that would burst in air and shower the fragments on the oncoming troops. And it had canister shot and grape shot. Canister shot, there was about 25 or 30 of these little things in there. They're solid iron balls, and they'd be in a tin can. And the can would be inserted in the muzzle and fired out. And what it would do, in effect, it'd create a huge shotgun out of it. These things would fly all over the place. These were primarily used for breaking up infantry attacks that were coming a little bit close. Canister shot. I think I got it right. Yeah, there'd be about 9 of these in it. And these would be wrapped up with iron bands and they'd be shot out, and with the purpose of basically the same as grape shot, only at a much greater distance. These would carry a lot farther. It was kind of nasty. I have a couple of bullets that were dug up at Chickamauga. As you see, they're, they do kind of spread out and mushroom. The reason was that they used pure lead in their Benny balls, and lead being soft, it didn't take much to expand it. Any hard object would make it to expand, including bones. If it hit anything, it would just like that. However, not all the mini balls were used to shoot at people. A lot of them were used to carve on to take over, kill some time. This particular one here was made into a nipple protector, such as I have on the Enfield. And they just stick that over the nipple on a rifle and put a hammer over it. If they ran out of a pencil, they made one. This used to be a mini ball at one time. They also made things for games. Nobody really knows what they made this one for, but it's just an odd shape. And if you wanted to unload your rifle without shooting it, you had a problem. Because they're way down there in the muzzle, or the barrel, and you can't really get to them to pull them out. So you had to what they call a worm, or a corkscrew, and you had to dig them out. This is what's left of one that was used in a revolver that somebody's dug out without firing. Basically, that's about it. And you see the infantry outfit is a little bit different. The cartridge box is on the side. It's held by a belt. Forgot about that one there. This here is the same as the one over there, only this is the original one. The one over there is replica. That's your standard infantry belt and buckle, U.S. buckle. As I said, this held 40 rounds in little tins like that. The main reason they were issued 40 rounds was any more than that cost money. And again, the government didn't like to spend money, so they'd be issued 40 rounds. They weren't supposed to shoot any more than that. However, there were cases where they had to, so they'd scrounge around and any cartridge box on soldiers that they might find had been killed, and they'd take extra bullets. But basically, that is about it. Flag, of course, here is our Michigan flag. This one over here is our battery flag, which is our battery letter in it. And these stars are arranged in it, sort of a circle pattern. I believe there's 34 or 35 stars on there. After the war broke out, some people decided wanted to subtract the stars so it represented the Confederacy. However, other people felt that as long as it was a secession, and they actually belonged to the Union as a rebellion, they ought to remain there in spite, you know, because it was to make the Confederates, you know, resentful of the fact that they still got our stars in the flag. It's just more games, it's like. But basically, that's about all. I guess I've got it.
Been with the battery, seeing interested in Civil War.
My personal interest started back years ago. I don't ever remember when it primarily started. I attribute it mainly to the early 60s. I think I was probably about 8 or 9 at that time. And Centennial was just starting up, and there was a lot of publicity about it. And I really got the bug up at Charlton Park when they used to have the NSSA would have cannon shoots up there. It's up by Hastings. At that time, I didn't know anything about it other than the cannons made a lot of noise. And I've been with the organization for 5 years now. A friend of mine told me about it, took me to one of the meetings, and I joined. I've been with it ever since.
Well, I think it's amazing how much information you have gained. And when you get to be the age of some of the rest of us, you'll be writing books.
I don't know about that. I'm not really that much of a book writer.
Do any of you folks have questions you'd like to ask John?
Yes.
How about the flints? Is there any difference in the flints? Is there some location where they fire better than other sources?
A lot of your better flints come from England. There's no really reason. A flint, you know, you pick up a piece of flint out here and it work, but not as well as the flints that come from over there. It's hard to explain. I don't know if anybody really knows why.
How about those flints
in
the Ohio flint?
Those, I assume, are, from what I understand, are pretty good flints. There are areas here in the United States that produce really good flints, but supposedly, or traditionally, I should say, I suppose, the best flints come from
England. Are there any other questions?
Then
you shoot or those at your
meeting? This Zouave model here. That's the standard. That's the one I use primarily. I don't claim to be no Sergeant York or anything like that, you know.
It is a competitive shoot.
Oh, yes. Our shoots are based on time. We are allowed 8 minutes, 6 to 8 minutes to break targets that are assigned to us. We have eight men on our rifle team, and usually there are 2 to 4 targets per man, and we have to fight against time to break all of them. The ones with the shortest time win. We do have variations in our shoot for targets. As I said, we have clay pigeons and flower pots. Occasionally, we'll get pop cans, and we'll shoot those. And they fly around real pretty when they break because of all the pressure. We have what we call a stake shoot, which is a board. It's 6 inches wide by 3/4 inch thick, by about 2 foot long, and we paint a line on it, and we have to shoot it in half with our bullets. That's really quite it can be frustrating at times because it's just a tiny little piece that holds it together, and you really don't know where it's at. And you spend a lot of time trying to figure out why it didn't break, and I've seen places where the event will be over, the board will fall apart. So it's really quite, it's kind of fun. If you want to really see something spectacular in June, about the 19th and 20th at Greenfield Village, we have a muzzleloader shoot there. And a lot of the units in the NSSA show up there primarily on Sunday. And we have a shoot there. And we have a variation in our stake event there, because we have a 2x4 we have to shoot in half. And then on each side of it, there are 2 dynamite caps, which is, we have to shoot at those after we cut the stake in half, which is supposed to give the effect of cannon fire and musket fire at the same time. And that, it's really quite something. They also demonstrate the cannon.
What distance are you firing at?
Our main distance for the rifle are 50 and 100 yards, and the cannon is 200. The revolver is 25, I believe.
Your cannon then shoots just the ball rather than the shrapnel?
Oh, yes, for safety purposes. We're very strict on our safety. A few years ago, back in the 60s, there was a rather bad accident over at Frontier Village, Frontier City, where there was in the Irish Hills, where I believe 2 or 3 men were killed. Primarily because it was not really an NSSA sponsored shoot. The North South had teams there, and they were very lax in their powder. They had an 85 pound of black powder, keg, open. Somebody tossed a cigarette in or something. It just blew on. Now, we cannot have any open powder on the line. It has to be in pre-measured tubes. And we're very careful. We have a guy who is a safety director in behind each one of the teams. And he keeps an eye on you. If you're doing something wrong, he'll tell you about it. He has the authority to pull a team off the line if he feels they're unsafe. We're really very strict. We only approve, the organization only approves certain arms that we meet certain specifications. So we have to be really selective on which type of firearm we want to use.
Well, we certainly enjoyed this. Well, thank you very much. I happen to think...